Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear was originally aired in 2012, and here it is. Today you'll hear the final part of a speech by CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer, given in Seattle in September of 2011. Susan Lindauer wrote the book Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq, The Ultimate Conspiracy to Silence Truth, which came out in 2010. Susan Lindauer is an American journalist and an anti-war activist. In 2003, she was accused of conspiring to act as an unregistered lobbyist for the Iraqi intelligence service and engaging in prohibited financial transactions with the government of Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Lindauer was found mentally unfit to stand trial in two separate hearings, even though the medical staff at the Carswell Air Force Base, where she was imprisoned for a year, stated that she was not mentally ill. During her incarceration, she won the right to refuse forced antipsychotic medication to make her competent to stand trial. She was released in 2006, and all charges were dropped in 2009. So let's begin with the final part of her speech.
Well, I learned some things about the media that I hope you never find out. Richard Fuse got paid off $13 million. There may have been others who also got paid off.
Richard Fuse was her CIA handler.
My friend who knows about the security videos will not talk publicly at this, even now, because he's afraid of losing his pension. He's got a great job at the State Department. He's going to retire. He's in his late 50s. He's got, you know, 6 or 7 more years to go. He wants to stay. He loves his life. He doesn't want to quit his job. He doesn't want to get fired. And he's afraid because the whistleblowers are screwed in this country. We are screwed if we talk. And people get the message, believe me. If you're looking at me and you're like, oh, I know some stuff about 9/11 too. And what did they do to Susan? Oh, they're throwing her in prison. Yeah, she's in prison now. Yeah, they've just destroyed her reputation. Gee, do you want to be me? If you're in the intelligence community, do you want to be me? Good question. Do I have a lawsuit against the government for what they did to me? And the answer is no. I spent 5 years under indictment, and I talked with my attorney about it, and he said, if you do that, they will slap a non-disclosure agreement, a gag order on you while the case was being heard. It would take 2 or 3 years, and I decided that my revenge would be telling the truth. And my attorney was like... Thank you. And I want you to know, my attorney told me that he said, I bet we could get you $2 million. And he said, and my share of the fees would be about $1 million. But I believe that this story is so important that I will give up my fees, and I urge you to give up any fees that you would get so that you have a chance to tell people, because people need to hear this stuff. There has got to be accountability in our democracy, or you lose your democracy, which is what's happening right now.
And now she's asked a question about Osama bin Laden and how he was in a hospital on 9/11 with a serious disease. And now, 10 years later, they take him out and there's a burial at sea. And he wants to know what her take is on that.
Well, you know what's really funny is this is really important that he had a kidney disease that requires constant treatment. And we're supposed to believe that he lived for 10 years without ever receiving any treatment again in the caves of Afghanistan, which would have aggravated his medical decline and killed him even faster. And yet somehow he managed to live for 10 years without any extra additional medical care at all. I don't think it flies at all. And the burial at sea is awfully convenient. Yeah, no pictures. Yeah.
And now she's asked, if the Libyans weren't responsible for Lockerbie, do you have any idea who was?
Yes. Abu Elias, the man who put the bomb on the airplane, lives in Virginia. He lives 6 miles from my house in Northern Virginia. And he's been protected by the FBI and the CIA all these years. He's on a client basis. He's paid a stipend, a living stipend, with our tax dollars. And it is all geared to protect the CIA from its exposure of this heroin trafficking ring, which continued through the 1990s. When I met Richard Fuse in 1994, and he told me about it, he said, "Susan, you," I was like, "Oh, that's old. You know, that's like it." I thought that my original reaction was that the heroin trafficking must have stopped after Lockerbie because they would have somebody would have discontinued it. And he said, "No. They're still profiting from this, and they receive like 3% of the cut from the heroin trade out of the Bekaa in Lebanon." What was the motivation for Lockerbie? And why was Pan Am 103 chosen? In fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency had filed a complaint in Washington, and a team had been sent out for, like, an internal affairs team had been sent out from the CIA encompassing the FBI and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they had gone into Lebanon and were gathering forensic evidence to prove the CIA's role in heroin trafficking. And they boarded Pan Am 103 that morning, and they were flying back to Washington to deliver their report with heroin and finance, cash and banking records and stuff like that. And they were going to expose the whole lot. And that's when the plane was bombed. What's interesting is that the State Department put out an emergency broadcast alert, essentially, travel advisory to all the embassies, telling everybody to get off that plane because that plane on that date was expected to be targeted in a terrorist attack. And so embassy staff in South Africa got off. President Botha got off the plane. He was supposed to be on that plane. And, you know, the South African apartheid Botha was supposed to be on that plane. And other diplomats did. And they freed up seats for young students traveling from Syracuse University to board the plane on their, they were flying standby to go home for Christmas holidays, and they all died in the attack. So it's a really ugly thing where the government, again, is protecting itself. They're allowing the terrorist attack to occur because, in fact, they facilitated it. They made sure that Islamic Jihad knew which flight that the investigative team was taking back and said, "Hey, why don't you take care of this for us?"
And now a woman asks, "So have you spoken to any of our elected representatives, or do they pretend like they never heard of you?"
This is a very important question. I'm really glad you asked this. When I was first, my indictment ended 5 days before Obama's inauguration, I had prepared a lengthy paper for the Senate Intelligence Committee, which would be Senator Dianne Feinstein. Got this? Ooh, California. Ooh, Senator Ron Wyden, Oregon, who used to be my boss. I was his press secretary. Oh my. And I took this to him and I said, "You better read this." And this goes into detail about the history. It became the backdrop for my book. So if you get my book, you'll see what I told Ron Wyden. But it is a detailed report on 9/11. It is a detailed report on the 9/11 warnings and the 9/11 investigation and the whole fraud about anti-terrorism in real time. It breaks it out according to how the events happened, like January, February, March, April, all this stuff. It is a 117-page document. And they knew in great detail, profound detail, all of the stuff that we're talking about in depth, in much, like, this is a, you know, we're scratching the surface tonight, but they knew in depth, and they have lied to you ever since. They really have. They've been lying. They just, every time they look at you and they open their mouths on Iraq or 9/11 or terrorism or the wars or national security policy, the whole thing is a scam. Yemen. I covered Libya, Yemen, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Malaysia. And all that stuff, every time they talk to you about any of those subjects, they're lying to you. And they know they're lying to you.
And next, the gentleman says that he's read about the amount of money made off the world heroin trade, which was something like $500 billion, he thought. And he asks, how much is the CIA siphoning off, and how do the banks hide all of this money?
Oh, I think that drug trade is holding up the banks right now. I think that the drug cartel trade and the money that they're generating is propping up our international monetary system.
Previously in her talk, Susan spoke of the 11 letters that she sent to her cousin Andy Card about her work in Iraq as a CIA asset on the peace framework that was being developed prior to 9/11. And Andy Card was Bush's Joint Chief of Staff. A gentleman in the audience now asks if those letters have been made public, and if not, could they possibly be made public?
When I was under indictment, I could put those out on the internet. Well, I've got them. Let me tell you about the Patriot Act that was so beautiful. The Patriot Act meant that they wiretapped, I can prove everything. They wiretapped 28,000 phone calls, 8,000 emails, hundreds of fax transmissions that are date and time stamped to prove they were sent. And they were date and time stamped to members of Congress. they were mine, and under the Patriot Act, they're allowed to have the different drafts that you write. When you write a paper, you write a letter, you have 10 drafts of the letter. The Patriot Act means that we have every single copy of each paragraph and each change of the paragraph through the whole progression of the letter. We had 10,000 pages of documents. And all of it indicts the federal government and shows what garbage this was. I had an email database for that I put together myself, every chief of staff, every legislative director, every press secretary, and every foreign policy advisor in the House and the Senate, Democrat and Republican. And I was pounding these guys. I created that on my own. I was pounding these guys with anti-war papers. Not, some of them I wrote myself, and some of them you guys, you know, other people wrote that were really good stuff, and I was making sure everybody got to see them. And yet they turn around and say that no one in the intelligence community tried to warn Congress that this war would be a disaster, that the assumptions they were working from were faulty and should be distrusted. And that's just flat out a lie. I was arrested because I did give them the papers. And then after I gave them the papers, they complained that, and I was safely under indictment and locked in prison. They say, oh, no, we didn't hear from this woman at all. She didn't give us anything. And they tell you that I was incompetent, that the asset. I mean, you remember, if you listen to George Bush, whenever he talks about the war and pre-war intelligence, he says, oh, it was that bad intelligence. Those assets screwed us. They really hurt us by not telling us what was really going to happen. Totally bunk. BS.
And the next question is about Senator Dianne Feinstein. And the member of the audience wants to know, if she knew about all of this about Iraq, did she also know about 9/11 prior to when it occurred?
She has known about the cover-up since it happened. She would have known from September 12th on if she didn't know it before.
The same gentleman from the audience continues by saying that he's read recently that virtually every member of Congress, since about 2005, has had their net worth, at the very least, doubled, sometimes increasing by 10, 15, or 20-fold. And he says, since they've been silent about all of this, are they doing it for their own self-interest, or do you think that they're afraid they're going to go to jail?
What really offends me most about politicians, and it's not only Dianne Feinstein, they're all doing it. They're all grandstanding on 9/11. They're demagoguing this issue. They're playing to the emotions of the people. They're pretending to be patriots. Oh, we're so strong. We're going to defend America. Well, they're not. They're doing a lousy job. They failed in their leadership obligations. They are not watching the federal purse. They really don't know how terrorism investigations get done. They've made bad decisions in their choices that are exacerbating the problem. There are more terrorists who hate us now than ever before. And when we first started doing terrorism work, there were only 200 to 300 individuals in the whole world who would have been considered terrorists. And they were serious. They were deadly serious. They were out to get at anything they could. Most of them were after Israel, but they were also coming after us too. But now there's, 50,000 people? Does that mean every Muslim in the world is a terrorist? No way. Yeah, but maybe 50,000 of them are, up from 200. That's a failure. That's a serious failure. And they left the money in circulation that would have cut off their operations globally. And that's just a disaster. That's got to be the worst decision.
And the next person asks about the organizations that are supposed to protect us, like the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, etc. And he said it seems like they've been co-opted by other interests. And how many people in these agencies, leaders and workers there, are still loyal to the U.S. and are trying to get rid of these renegade forces within the agencies?
The real problem that we're having right now is that the intelligence community was gutted by George Bush and severely demoralized. Anybody who refused to politicize the intelligence reporting, they essentially decided that intelligence should make politicians look good and should protect the leadership of the country rather than the people. And so anyone who didn't agree with that philosophy was driven out. And now Leon Panetta under Obama has made a really strong effort to revive the traditions of independence, because good intelligence is not supposed to tell you what politicians want to hear. They're supposed to give you a brutally cold, honest assessment of what the heck is really going on, because that's what you really need to know. Like, you need to know right now that in Libya, the NATO rebels are radical Islamists who want to reinstate Sharia. If you want to reinstate Sharia, and if you want to have a radical Islamic state in Libya, then you should continue to support the rebels. But if you think you're supporting a democratic group of people, then you are in the wrong place. And that's what a good intelligence is going to tell you. They're going to make sure that you know what you're really facing and what you're really dealing with. And people who will lie to you are not doing you any favors. It's not to your advantage for an intelligence community to lie to politicians.
The next question from the audience is, do you trust Ron Paul?
Oh, there's some things that Ron Paul believes that I think are just so wonderful, and I just hope that, I think we need somebody to have integrity. Whether I agree with all of his politics or not is not really the issue. We need to have somebody who's going to stand outside the system, who's willing to say what he's saying. But so I don't trust any politicians anymore. <You know? laughs> I do like Bernie Sanders.
The next question I've been waiting for someone to ask. They state that she appears to be a LIHOP advocate, and LIHOP means let it happen on purpose with regards to 9/11, as opposed to made it happen on purpose. And so he asks, you appear to be a LIHOP advocate, and if so, why?
Well, I think that they certainly desired for it to happen. So they let it happen, they desired for it to happen. I'm a DIHOP believer. They desired it, and they made it possible. They did everything they could to take the gloves off and to take away any constraints. Ordinarily, so many things would have kicked in to stop that attack. It just would have been moving so fast.
Here, someone in the audience shouts out about planting explosives in the buildings as being a MIHOP situation.
Is it MIHOP? Yes. Yes. And the thing is, I don't know who did it. I really don't know. I suspect that I could guess, like, who benefited from it? Who benefited? That's the question. And once you answer that question, who benefited, then, you know, but it wasn't us, and it wasn't. But then, you know, it's like what this lady was saying earlier, you know, if you say we did this, we didn't know about, we didn't make this happen, our government made it happen. And so can you blame a whole country if a few people do terrible things? And part of it, part of the crew was on the let it happen basis, and then a few, I call it an orphan team. In my book, I say it was an orphan team that went in and did it. And they knew that a terrorist attack was going to have, that any normal terrorist attack is going to have a lot of smoke and noise and commotion, and it'll be exciting, and then the smoke will clear and you'll see there's not that much damage. And if there's not enough damage and if there's not maximum destruction, then you cannot fulfill the agenda of going into war with Iraq. And what's so important is to understand that that motivation already existed before 9/11 had happened. They'd already decided what they were going to do. They were already issuing the threats to the Iraqis. And they knew the approximate timing of the attack because they were telling everybody to stay out of New York City. They were telling the intelligence community to stay out of New York City. And so then it would be very easy for someone else to go in, wire the building. They probably had the architectural blueprints and just go in you say it took several weeks to do, it would ordinarily take several weeks to do. According to what I am told, these vans only appeared for 10 days. So maybe it would not have been enough time to do it. But that's what I'm just telling you what I was told. Oh, they were supposed to come down. And they wired Building 7 as well, which is interesting because they weren't hit. That building wasn't hit at all. What is there, shock waves that all of a sudden the building collapses?
Now a member of the audience states that the security cameras had been turned off 2 weeks prior to the attacks.
See, there you go. There you go. But in the parking garage, they were capturing vans coming in and out. They know what they looked like. So they may have had some cameras off in the building, like in the stairwells, in the elevators.
And next, the member of the audience is commenting on the benefits that the U.S. government got from 9/11, including Bush's ratings going way up after 9/11, taking away our civil liberties, taking the focus away from investigating the banking situation, and also he talked about the money made on the put options on 9/11.
The short-stopping on the stock market was CIA, top-level CIA people who bet against the market on that day, yeah.
Yeah.
Insider trading, yeah.
Susan's cousin was Bush's Joint Chief of Staff on 9/11, and his name was Andy Card. And he's the one who whispered in Bush's ear on the morning of 9/11 when he was in the classroom in Florida that the towers had just been hit. And the question is, how much did Bush know prior to 9/11?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you ask about that because it is my cousin who told George Bush that the attack had occurred. And you'll notice that he doesn't get upset. Most people would be like, what? So there was a terrorist attack on the United States? And he acts like he already knows. And he did. He already knew. And I have, in my book, I found a very damning interview that he gave in Florida after the attack, and it talked about the video that was shot by the Israeli Mossad team. And he knew, now this is really interesting, he says in the interview that he gave, he said that he had already seen the footage. The Mossad video was not released to the public until the next day.
And this concludes the speech and the Q&A that author and CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer gave in Seattle in September of 2011. You can see her giving this speech by going to YouTube and searching for Susan Lindauer and Seattle. As I mentioned on a previous show, members of the 9/11 Truth Movement have a mixed response to Susan Lindauer. Earlier on today's show, she talked about Al-Qaeda growing from 200 members in 2001 to 50,000 members now, as a result of our government response to 9/11, according to her. Her belief that Al-Qaeda did 9/11 is one of the reasons the Truth Movement has a mixed reaction to her. Here are some of the reasons why. Osama bin Laden was working for the CIA right up until 9/11. Several of the alleged hijackers were trained on U.S. military bases. Paul Rhea states in his book, Mounting Evidence, that, quote, although the FBI had put a $25 million bounty on bin Laden's head, it never charged him for the crime of 9/11. In 2006, the Bureau dropped him from its most wanted list. According to Chief of Investigative Publicity Rex Toom, the FBI had no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. Later in 2006, the CIA closed Alex Station, its elite special unit devoted to Al-Qaeda. And now I'm going to close the show by reading you part of an article called The United States and Its Comrade-in-Arms, Al-Qaeda, and Other Tales of an Empire Gone Mad by William Bloom. And it was posted recently on the website globalresearch.ca. And here goes. Afghanistan in the 1980s and 90s Bosnia and Kosovo in the 90s, Libya 2011, Syria 2012. In military conflicts in each of these countries, the United States and Al-Qaeda, or one of its associates, have been on the same side. What does this tell us about the United States' war on terrorism? Regime change has been an American goal on each occasion, overthrowing communists, Serbians, Slobodan Milosevic, Muammar Gaddafi, Bashar al-Assad, all heretics or infidels, all non-believers in the empire, all inconvenient to the empire. Why, if the enemy is Islamic terrorism, has the United States invested so much blood and treasure against the PLO, Iraq, Libya, and now Syria, all Mideast secular governments? Why are Washington's closest Arab allies in the Middle East and Islamic governments of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Jordan, and Bahrain, Bahrain being the home of an American naval base, Saudi Arabia and Qatar being conduits to transfer arms to the Syrian rebels? Why, if democracy means anything to the United States, are these same close allies in the Middle East all monarchies? Why, if the enemy is Islamic terrorism, did the United States shepherd Kosovo, 90% Islamist, and perhaps the most gangsterish government in the world, to unilaterally declare independence from Serbia in 2008, an independence so illegitimate and artificial that the majority of the world's nations still have not recognized it? Why, if the enemy is Islamic terrorism, did the United States pave the way to power for the Libyan Islamic rebels, who at this very moment are killing other Libyans in order to institute a more fundamentalist Islamic state? Why do American officials speak endlessly about human rights, yet fully support the Libyan Islamic rebels, despite the fact that Doctors Without Borders suspended its work in prisons in the Islamic rebel city of Misrata because torture was so rampant that some detainees were brought for care only to make them fit for further interrogation? Why is the United States supporting Islamic terrorists in Libya and Syria who are persecuting Christians? So, if you want to understand this thing called United States foreign policy, forget about the war on terrorism, forget about September 11, forget about democracy, forget about freedom, forget about human rights, forget about religion, forget about the people of Libya and Syria. Keep your eyes on the prize. Whatever advances American global domination, whatever suits their goals at the moment, there's no moral factor built into the DNA of U.S. foreign policy. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.